Pre-recorded, completely unscripted, and about as organised as the thought processes of some members of the Australian Senate, you're listening to news, views and opinions on events from here at home and around the globe on politics, business and society in general. This is the Iron Fist and the Velvet Glove.
Welcome back, dear listener, for episode 35. I am the Iron Fist. With me is Scott, the Velvet Glove. How are you, Scott?
I'm very well, thanks, Trevor. How's yourself?
Very good. I've got a big pile of items in front of me to run through this week. The religious world.
Yeah, we do have quite a lot, yes.
They haven't let us down. There's plenty has happened. And to kick things off, Scott, I mentioned last week how I had contact with Amy Remicus, or Remicus, of the Brisbane Times. And I thought she was kind of going to be on side or potential to help us out. And lo and behold, during the week, she's come through with an article on the Brisbane Times about religious education in Queensland schools. And we even get it mentioned.
She says, she mentioned the Secular Party of Australia.
She says
the secular movement is growing in Queensland with groups such as Secular Public Education, Queensland Parents for Secular State Schools, and a political party, the Secular Party of Australia, all working to remove religious instruction from curriculum hours in state schools.
So
that's pretty good.
And she goes on to give a bit of a blurb to say that somebody's quoted here, Ms. Cortis. I think my printout of it isn't too clear, but anyway, Ms. Cortis is quoted as saying, in her experience with her children's school at Windsor, parents were shocked to learn religious instruction involved sin and salvation rather than history or lessons on other denominations outside the Christian sphere, which is a good point. Scott?
Like, it is a very good point, It is a very good point because I don't know if it was this article, but there was an article that I read during the week saying that the use of the term religious education helps the religious instruction fly under the radar.
Yes.
And, you know, because if you use the word education in there, you tend to believe it's going to be educational, and then you then find out that it's not educational, it's instructional.
So in different states around Australia, the terminology gets mixed up a bit, but certainly in Queensland and most states and most groups when you talk to them, religious instruction refers to an indoctrination type class, whereas religious education refers to a historical comparative sort of lesson. So,
which is be quite all right for the kids to be subjected to.
We would not have a problem with that. So it was a good, you know, at least that's something in the media in Brisbane about that. So I think we need to highlight the just what goes on in these classes. And I mentioned a couple of weeks ago how I have got hold of the Connect series of teaching materials, and this is what Scripture Union teachers are using in classes for kids, you know, as young as 5 to 7 years. And, you know, the first lesson number one was about how bad the Jews were for disobeying God and not wiping out an entire population of other groups. Was it the Canaanites? Maybe it was. I forget which one it was.
But I can't remember, but I remember the vague story anyway. That there was basically the Jews got in trouble from God for not committing genocide.
Exactly. So that was lesson number one. And so just reading that article just prompted me to look at lesson number two, and this one is about Samuel, and basically, the moral of the lesson that is given to the kids is that that there was a lady called Hannah who was very sad because she couldn't have a child. She was barren. And she went to the temple and basically prayed and made a promise to God that if she, you know, would agree to give up her baby to God, then God would, you know, let her have a baby. And it's a horrible story about then the baby's born and she gives up the baby, Samuel, to the priest of the temple to look after, and makes him a coat, you know, a bit bigger every year as he gets bigger. But it's just a story, you know, young kids will come out of it thinking, well, gosh, if I have problems having a baby, well, Jesus, or God will solve it by through prayer. Terrible story. So I think we should try and do something. I should try and pitch something to Amy about an article about these crazy lessons that are actually in this book. And see,
well, the lessons, yeah, I think you'd be dead on the, you'd bang on the money there. If you actually expose what's in the lessons, then people start to have a different view of the world.
Yeah, I think that's what we need to do. I think it's not obvious to people what the what's going on. So anyway, a bit of a word for the secular party and a bit of news about it, and that's all good. Timing of the plebiscite. You would have been across this during the week, Scott.
Yes, well, you know, I was a little bit angry when I first read this, but I've settled down since then. You know, the timing of the plebiscite came, well, I mean, it was more than anything else. I think Brandis let the cat out of the bag that they've basically decided on a July 2 election. So that's what he's got. That's what he's got in trouble for. Was that he said, you know, well, we'll have the plebiscite by the end of the year. Turnbull had said before that it would be after the election.
Yes.
So that fits in with the July 2 election.
Yeah. So the theory being, if you're going to have a plebiscite by the end of the year, then it must be a relatively early election to fit it all in. So, and then Turnbull's come out and said, well, may not necessarily be, but trying to keep all the options open. So, so yes. Anyway, Labor has pledged that they'll call for a vote on same-sex marriage within 100 days if they come into power.
Yes. And that's what Labor's, that's Labor's policy, is that they'll have a vote on same-sex marriage within 100 days of forming government.
Yeah.
Now, where was that? Then. Now, the bit that I thought was very interesting was the opposition leader Bill Shorten said the coalition could settle the issue with a vote in Parliament during the next sitting period. Mr. Shorten said on Sunday the plebiscite was an idea created by opponents of marriage equality to kick marriage equality down the road. Our objection to the plebiscite aren't that delaying tactic designed by opponents to marriage equality, he said. It's just a very expensive opinion poll. Well, it is a very expensive opinion poll, but I think the subheading was vote could rip the Band-Aid off unpleasant views. I think that's where the big problem with the plebiscite is.
Yep.
Is that you're going to end up with some very unpleasant views being expressed. And they'll be able to be expressed because it's the it'll be an election campaign. And, yeah, that's my biggest beef with the plebiscite, is that you'll get some very unpleasant stuff being said.
I think that's all going to pan out. So it'll happen one way or another. It's going to get there, but we'll just have
to see. It's going to get there. Yeah, it is going to get there. And we will get... I mean, the... I've no doubt that the plebiscite will be won by the yes case. However...
You're worried about the Parliament.
I'm not worried about the Parliament. I'm worried about the parliamentarians because, you know, Morrison, who we've profiled before, Scott Morrison has come out and he has flagged the prospect of ministers campaigning on both sides of the same-sex marriage plebiscite as happened in the Republic referendum.
Yep.
Morrison said he did not plan to keep his opinion on same-sex marriage to himself, and I don't think anyone should. Now, viewers will remember us when we did profile Scott Morrison. He was from the wacky, you know, Hillsong group. And, you know, they're not the nicest people when it comes to marriage equality.
No.
So we can understand where his views would lie.
Yeah.
But it is, it was very interesting that he came out and said that. Anyway.
Mm. Well, yes. While we're on Scott Morrison, there was also a report came out about negative gearing, and it came out from BIS Shrapnel, and the executive summary outlined potentially catastrophic consequences of mooted changes to negative gearing. And there's an article here by Peter Ryan of The Drum, and the sort of guts of the article is that he saw this report and his immediate reaction was, well, who commissioned this report? Because, you know, as we know, the old adage, or as he says, in the cynical world of consultancy, he who commissions research and writes the parameters can expect a desired outcome. So it's crucially important to know who paid BIS Shrapnel for that report. Was it the property council? And the BIS people said they couldn't say. And Scott Morrison was quizzed on AM about it. And he basically said, well, he didn't know, but it's BIS Shrapnel and that should be just good enough. And the idea that you would need to know who commissioned it was totally, you know, Scott Morrison just fluffed it off and says, well, it's BIS Shrapnel report. I mean, everyone knows who BIS Shrapnel is. They're a respected economic consultancy firm, and you don't need to ask who paid for it. Like, this is just what you'd expect from Scott Morrison.
That's a ridiculous answer, isn't it? Because, you know, it's like the cynical line is that, you know, whoever commissions the report basically commissions the report to be written in a certain way and then comes up with the answer that they were after. And go on.
It turns out anyway that this report revealed, the author of the report revealed, it had been written in 2015 and was not related to Labor's negative gearing policy anyway. Like,
yeah, exactly.
Yeah. But with all these things, like, as I mentioned before, these groups that come out and say stuff, particularly business councils and other people, they've got their own agendas and can't be trusted.
No, they can't be trusted.
So, and Scott Morrison definitely can't be trusted. So anyway, that was, while we're talking about Scott Morrison, there's another dig at him as to, well, he's very unlikable. Now, Scott, another article, a reporter from News Corp, I think, or the Daily Telegraph, Alison Bevidge, went to report on the radical Islamic group Hizbut Tahrir. Is that how you pronounce it?
Hizbut Tahrir. Yeah.
In Australia in 2014, and she went to this this public speech that was being given, and when she arrived, the crowd was segregated by sex. So she objected, good on her, and it went to the New South Wales Civil and Appeals Tribunal, who found that the spokesperson for the group, Ismail Al-Wawa, was personally liable for discrimination and saying that for all future public events, they must clearly state at their venues and informational materials that segregated seating is not compulsory. So good on that female reporter for saying not good enough and taking that group on. I mean, the notion in Australia that an audience at a public event would be divided on sex gender grounds is just abhorrent, Scott.
It is abhorrent, and I'm glad that she took it to the courts. And that she, and what I'm really glad about is that she got the result that she was after.
Yeah, except I think she was asking for money.
She wasn't. She was after compensation, which she didn't get.
Yeah.
But you know, she's now had the situation that they, you know, that they can no longer enforce the segregation of women and men.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't have suspected such a thing happening in Australia. Maybe Birmingham or something. But there you go. Now, Scott, John Howard has, recently celebrated 20 years since his election as Prime Minister, and there's been a few events sort of looking back fondly at his time. I don't know why, because it wasn't a very good time for Australia and some of the things he did. But anyway, he's been in the news a bit, and he made a statement that he feels that the Christian right feels silenced. Complaining that all of the criticism that's being levied at them is unfair and making them afraid to say things, Scott.
Yeah, which is an absolutely ridiculous thing to say. I mean, the ACL has not been silenced. The ACL has been vocal and saying everything they want to say. They've come out, they feel emboldened enough to say that they want the discrimination laws, or whatever laws you want to call it, paused for the duration of the marriage equality debate. You know, it's a ridiculous thing for him to actually say.
What planet is he on? Like, people are too scared to speak. I mean, you hear Corey Bernardi, Eric Abetz, ACL. Like, these people aren't scared to speak. If you try pushing them off the platform and to get your own voice in, it's not easy.
No, it's not easy, and it's ridiculous that he's said this. Yeah. I mean, Corey Bernardi is not one to shut up.
Yep. I mean, people will just say things and get away with it. They'll just say that, you know, tomorrow, you know, the sun is going to rise in the west and set in the east, and it doesn't, and they don't get in trouble for it. Like, you can just make wrong statements and nobody cares anymore. Like, that's just completely wrong and nobody cares.
Well, I mean, the thing is that he said it on the, well, I don't know, presumably 60 Minutes by the looks of this picture.
Mm.
New Matilda's the people that have actually reported this, but it was an absolutely ridiculous thing for him to say. And yeah, it's
one thing he does refer to in it is the whole thing about the Tasmanian church distributing a pamphlet about gay same-sex marriage debate, and the fact that they've been taken to court over that. So he mentions that as an issue, and we've said before we've got some sympathy over that, that you should be able to... You know, anyway,
I've got sympathy with the ACL when they want the these laws paused.
Yes,
but you know, well, we've got them. We'll stick by them.
Anyway, the Institute of Public Affairs has criticised the investigation in Tasmania. And this is a quote from the Institute of Public Affairs, who may as well be the ACL, it seems. Here's the quote. If the Catholic Church cannot distribute a booklet on Catholic teachings to Catholics, who can it distribute them to? Is what it says. But what a terrible argument. I mean, just because it's the Catholic Church distributing a Catholic booklet doesn't mean it's okay. Like, if it's the Nazi Party distributing a Nazi booklet, then it's not okay. Like, it depends on the content. But these people, like the IPA and the Australian Christian Lobby, just think because it's the Catholic Church, that should be good enough. That's their argument. Well, it's us. It's not because of other things. It's just because it's us and we're the good guys. And they expect... They're amazed when people don't take that as being a good enough argument.
Yeah, it's incredible that they actually opened their mouth like that and said it, you know.
Interestingly, Scott, this... I had a bit of a look then at the pamphlet that was distributed in Tasmania. And...
Yeah.
And it does have, it tries to make some statements about other reasons, but at the end of the day, it does talk about God. Marriage is where man and woman truly become one flesh, quoting Genesis, Matthew, and one of the other ones. And another part of the booklet there talks about God is the author of marriage, and the Catholic Church thinks marriage is a blessing from God. So in that document, they actually refer to God and the Bible as their real reasons. So clearly the ACL, I don't think, was involved in producing that, because they would have been careful to try and not use the words God. But this particular pamphlet does. So I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, it is.
Mm. Now, gay Mardi Gras. Have you ever been down for that, yes. Scott?
I've never been down, no. Right. No, I must go. Me and Brian were talking about going next year.
Yeah, yeah. It sounds like it would be a hoot.
Yeah.
So, I mean, gay or straight people or whatever, sounds like a great time down there.
Yeah, it is.
Now, there's a sort of a spoof article in an SBS comedy sort of article. and it's got some great lines in it. So remember, okay, folks, this is all not true, okay? It's all just like something you'd read in The Onion or whatever. So the Australian Christian Lobby has today announced plans to enter an anti-float into this year's Sydney Mardi Gras, and goes on to quote the supposed ACL campaigner. "It only goes in reverse," said one campaigner. "We thought that's the best way to symbolise our thoughts on the whole situation. Everyone is going to be trying to go one way, and we're going to obstinately demand to go in the other direction based on some outdated view on what we believe is traditional traffic flow." We feel that for too long in the history of Mardi Gras parades, the voice of the people who want to go the other way have been drowned out. Sounds like John Howard. We're the ones being silenced. We believe our float has as much right to be there as anyone else's float, and it's important that the Mardi Gras is representative of all voices, including voices that hate it and everything it stands for. It may seem like we're the only float going in the wrong direction, and that absolutely everyone else wishes we wouldn't, but there's actually a very strong, silent majority of other floats going the wrong direction that you simply can't see, hear, or detect in polling numbers. If anyone has a problem with this, we're more than happy to run an extensive poll as we drive down the heart of the parade over whether or not it's a good idea to do this. Of course, we will not be bound by the result. and the final part... Oh, actually, two more bits. We're just trying to say that it's fine for you to have a pride parade and say you're proud of who you are, but equally, we believe you should be deeply ashamed of who you are and need to change immediately. And finally, we want everyone to be able to have a good time and enjoy themselves, but feel that other people living their lives will lessen the enjoyment we have living ours. That's not acceptable. It's not that we believe they are bad people. We just want the law to reflect a belief that they are not equal to the rest of us. Is that so bad? It's a beautifully written piece of satire. I love that.
It was, yeah. It was very well. It was very well written. There's not a lot to say about it. It's very good. Yeah.
So he's really channeled his Lyle Shelton, that writer, or she has, and applied it to that situation brilliantly. So, now Scott, I don't think I sent you this one. Because I found one on statistics on morality.
Yeah.
And basically Pew Research Center, everyone, PEW, they do interesting surveys around the world. And they've surveyed 40,000 people in 40 different countries on 8 topics to see what people think of these as morally acceptable, unacceptable, or not a moral issue. So the things they asked were extramarital affairs, gambling, homosexuality, abortion, premarital sex, alcohol use, divorce, and contraceptive use. So it basically says, okay, extramarital affairs, do you think they are morally unacceptable, are they acceptable, or not a moral issue at all? So on that particular one, Scott, worldwide, 78% of people said extramarital affairs are unacceptable morally. 7% said acceptable, and 10% said not a moral issue. And Australia on that was pretty close, 79. So, and there's a separate one where we can compare Australia to the rest of the world. So Australia on that one is pretty close. 79, 4, and 13. But on the other ones, gambling, homosexuality, abortion, premarital sex, alcohol use, divorce, and contraceptive use, well, gambling, homosexuality, and abortion, worldwide, more than 50% of people think that those are immoral, morally unacceptable. Same with premarital sex and alcohol use, it's in the 40s, 40%, 46 and 42% of people think it's morally unacceptable. Divorce, 24%.
Really?
Yes. Contraceptive use, worldwide, people think it's 14%. Now, in Australia, on those issues, the part I like, that on all those other ones, abortion, gambling, alcohol use, homosexuality, premarital sex, divorce, and contraceptive use, you've got unacceptable, acceptable, and not a moral issue. And in Australia, the highest ranking item on all of those was not a moral issue. Good on you, Australia. Fantastic. Like, I just think that's brilliant that Australians go, hang on, abortion, gambling, alcohol, homosexuality, premarital sex, divorce, these aren't moral issues. So just goes to show, Scott, when, as we mentioned before, if people come from other parts of the world in massive numbers, they're going to have some very different ideas to us on what's even moral, let alone what their view of it is. So Pew Research, I've got a link to that one. Yes.
That's very interesting.
Mm. Speaking of surveys, folks, the Secular Party is conducting a survey and asking members, initially, which of our policies they find to be the most crucial, sort of ranking from most crucial to least crucial. So initially that was sent out to members, and then more recently on the Facebook page we've said, look, even if you're not a member, just tell us what you think. And results are in on that one. Scott, have you seen any of these results?
I have seen some of the results, yes.
So the biggest one was secular schooling, that to qualify for government funding, schools must teach secular curriculum. So that's the highest ranking in terms of crucial. Next was taxing religions. Next was freedom of expression, which included abolition of blasphemy laws. And equal with that was the chaplaincy policy. So they're the big ones as to what people find crucial. And interestingly, Scott, the one about religious attire was quite low ranking. People didn't really seem to be too concerned about religious attire.
Really?
Down the bottom, which I thought was interesting. So anyway, no doubt we'll discuss that at our next National Executive Meeting. But that was really good work by Karen, our Facebook editor, to gather all that information and get a feel for what people are thinking.
Yes, exactly. Mm.
Next up, Scott. Political donations. A quick article there.
Yes.
Basically,
it was very interesting.
Yeah. New South Wales has banned donations from property developers and capping what candidates can accept. And this is an article, again, from Amy Remicus. And basically saying no equivalent laws in Queensland. And these are important laws, Scott, I reckon.
Yeah, they are, very, very much so. They are very important laws.
We only have to look at the United States of America, where people donate large sums of money, and, well, look at the mess that you get into with the calibre of candidates who apply as a result.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah, it doesn't keep the lunatics out, does it?
People may not know, but the family who own, you know, Coca-Cola, called the Koch brothers, they are massive Republican Tea Party supporters, and they just pour in enormous amounts of money. But of course, they're complete nutters on the evangelical religious side, and so that's why we end up with the Ted Cruzes of the world over there. And, you know, if we're not careful, we'll get people making decisions here along those lines as well. So I think we should really severely restrict what donations people can make, particular property developers.
Well, I found that that's one of the things I found ridiculous about the laws in New South Wales was that it was only property developers that were being barred from making donations.
Mm.
Now, that strikes me as weird. I would have thought that if you're going to ban anyone, you'd ban the whole lot. Now, that then brings up the problem with unions.
Mm. Yes.
Because your unions have bankrolled the Labor Party for ever since they were started and so on and so forth. Now, Amy Remicus has made this point. She quotes a Dr. Paul Williams.
Yep.
He said, the issue of unions, however, is a trickier question because of the historical relationship with Labor.
Yep.
That may be the case, but I think that if you kill it off, if you have a set of rules that say that you can't make donations unless you're a member of the human race,
yep,
and that means no unions, no lobby groups, no businesses or anything else,
yep,
then you're going to end up having a much cleaner system.
Yeah.
I do believe that it really does need to be cleaned up.
Yeah. I'm kind of, I don't know, for some strange reason, I'm a little bit sympathetic about unions, but I agree with you that it kind of on the one, well, I do, kind of on the one hand, you think, well, yes, the unions pay all this money to the Labor Party, and so we know that the Labor Party is beholden to the unions, so we're not under any illusions because we just know that. But that's probably not a good enough argument. Like,
no, it's not really a good enough argument.
It would do the Labor Party good not to be so beholden to the unions anyway. Like,
exactly. They've got problems with the Labor Party, with their memberships and all that sort of stuff. They have to decide, you know, who's going to be members and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
Because I believe that, you know, if you're a member of a union, if you're a member of some unions, then your membership of the union gives you membership of the ALP and blah, 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 blah.
Yep.
So you end up with this ridiculous situation that the union movement represents, I can't remember what the statistic is, but I think it's 10, maybe 15% of the working population,
mm-hmm,
but they have 40% of the votes in the Labor Party.
Yep. Yeah.
You know, which is ridiculous.
And, you know, too much is spent on sort of electoral advertising anyway. Like, we've got a local government election in Brisbane coming up, and massive billboards around the place are festooned with, you know, pictures of the various candidates. And, you know, our home line rarely gets called these days because people only call you on your mobile, but it's ringing off the hook now with survey robots asking us who we're going to vote for. And it would do the parties good to spend less money anyway.
I think that's exactly right. I mean, I think that it would be worthwhile if the political parties were put on a financial diet,
yeah,
you know, so that they couldn't spend as much as what they do on advertising and that sort of stuff, and then it would force people to have more of a personal view of what happens,
yeah,
because they would then have to go down and attend a rally,
yeah,
that sort of
or
thing.
Read, yeah. I listened to a podcast once which was dealing with politicians in America again, and the amount of time that they had to spend on the phone begging for money was just crazy, and they hated it. Like, it was just an awful thing that they didn't want to do, but their organisations forced them to do it, and they had budgets. And even if they were represented a wealthy constituency, then they had a higher budget than a fellow with a poor constituency. So they were just tied to their phones begging for money a significant proportion of every week, and they personally would have loved a system that put a cap on spending, because then it meant that they wouldn't be forced to do these phone calls. And yeah. I reckon the politicians themselves, when it's put to them that, you know, if nobody's allowed to do it, then you won't be forced to beg for money at these functions and things, would think, well, that's a great idea. I'm glad to be out of that game. So unions and big business won't like it, but, you know, Scott, these are things that, you know, the Labor Party, like Anastasia Palaszczuk in Queensland, has just come in with zero ideas and they've done nothing. Like, these are all the sorts of things that Labor governments can come in and do, you know, things about religious instruction, donation laws. We're going to get on and talk about abortion law reform a bit later, and they've done absolutely nothing, this state government. Meanwhile, every week we've got something from the Andrews government where they're doing something. They just sit on their hands and done nothing, and now they've lost one of their Labor members, has decided to become quasi-independent, so their chances of getting anything done now are getting even slimmer. So it's just a real wasted opportunity that, you know, in the days of JB Jockey Peterson, the state Labor Party in Queensland would have been just itching to have some power to do something. And this crowd has got in with some power and done absolutely nothing and has just wasted, you know, 3 years.
Well, they have wasted their time so far. Mm. Yeah, for sure. Mm.
All right.
I personally think that they weren't, I don't think they were expecting to win.
No, that's right. So they Campbell Newman got unexpectedly rolled, and to their surprise and everyone else, they found themselves in power. Yeah.
Exactly. Mm. Yeah.
Another one I didn't send to you, I don't think, Scott. This is on Pew Research Center when I was mucking around there, and they were asking voters how they felt about blunt talk criticizing Islam. And basically, conservative voters were very much in favor of very blunt talk, blunt criticism of Islam, and Democratic voters were very much against blunt talk of Islam. So, Secular Party, Scott, would probably pitch itself to, you know, the centre-left of Australians. And
probably, yeah.
But, you know, if it follows the USA trend, they're the ones who actually don't want blunt speak about Islam. So we've got a bit of a problem there. Perhaps.
Yeah, I mean, it's crazy that they don't like the blunt talk.
Yeah.
You know, I would have thought that blunt talk about anything would be worth.
Yeah.
Would be worth.
Yeah. So Democrats, you know, 70%, be careful not to criticise Islam as a whole. Whereas Republicans, 70%. Speak bluntly, even if critical of Islam as a whole. So, I wish Pew Research would come and do that sort of polling in Australia. It would be interesting to know what people think here.
Yeah, exactly. Mm.
But that's a bit of a worry for us. Yeah. Okay, Scott, we have previously mentioned abortion laws and how confusing it was to know what the situation is. And I came across an article which basically gives you an Australia-wide summary of what's legal and not legal in terms of abortion in the various Australian states. So, in Queensland, we've got the Criminal Code basically saying attempting to terminate a pregnancy, you can get 14 years prison. But we've got a case which said an abortion is considered lawful in Queensland if carried out to prevent serious danger to the woman's physical and mental health. So that's something you've got to prove, serious danger to a woman's physical and mental health. And obviously, the police and the authorities are kind of, I think, Scott, would you agree, turning a blind eye to abortion in Queensland and just thinking, oh, well, you know, somebody can just say for mental health reasons they need this abortion. But in somewhere like Victoria, it states very clearly that up to 24 weeks, abortions can be performed by a registered medical practitioner with the woman's consent. And after 24 weeks, two doctors must consider an abortion to be appropriate in all the circumstances. Like, why hasn't the Queensland government and the New South Wales government, which is also behind the times on this, passed, you know, Victorian-type laws? Like, again, Anastasia Palaszczuk in Queensland, Labor government, female premier, why wouldn't you pass an abortion law like the one in Victoria?
Well, the thing is, she's got no upper house to have to deal with. You know, now, admittedly, she's in a minority government now. You know, but those independents, you could cajole them into supporting you on this.
And put the pressure on them, like, at least give it a go. Yeah. So, just a wasted opportunity again. So anyway, I don't know. I've never had to deal with this issue, Scott. I suspect lots of people travel to Victoria or Tasmania, which seems to be similar, for abortions.
It certainly looks that way, doesn't it? You know, where you go down, you know, up to 16 weeks, abortions can be provided by a medical practitioner with the woman's consent in Tasmania, and up to 24 weeks in Victoria. Yeah. You know, it looks to me that if you find yourself that you are pregnant and you want to terminate the child, terminate the pregnancy, then the thing to do is to go to Victoria.
Mm. Yep. So that's interesting because we were discussing that previously and we really struggled to find the answer. And in a one-page chart, there's an absolutely comprehensive setting out of the abortion law in Australia. Very good.
Absolutely.
You, Scott, have previously talked about separating religious and civil wedding ceremonies. Is that right?
Yes, I have. Yes, and I had a little victory when I wrote to one of the guys that was high up in the Presbyterian Church, where they had talked about walking away from performing legal marriage ceremonies, and I said to them that a perfectly reasonable thing to do, and I congratulated him for saying it.
Yep. So, George Brandis instigated a study by the Australian Law Reform Commission into religious freedom and kind of looking at 18C, which we've talked about before, which is this section which says it's an offence to offend, insult, humiliate or intimidate anyone based on their ethnicity, colour of the skin, etc. So, you know, it's an offence to offend somebody is a pretty broad brush and I don't like it. And the Law Reform Commission... Law Reform Commission said that that word offend could be interpreted too widely and basically said that we haven't had any problems with it so far, but probably worth looking at, I think, was the nuts and bolts of their decision. But along the way, they also said that there's no evidence that Commonwealth anti-discrimination laws significantly encroach on the freedom of religion in Australia. And so George Brandis is probably hoping for something else other than that conclusion. And in the same report, they've talked about kind of separating the function. So I guess, Scott, to delineate religious and civil weddings, everyone has to have a civil sort of piece of paper, and then it's up to you whether you also have a religious ceremony to go with it.
Well, that'd be my argument. That'd be the way I'd do it. And I'm pretty sure I'm right when I say the Italians do it that way, in that you go and get married in a office block in your lunch hour, and then you go and have your wedding with the whole family and that sort of stuff down the track.
Yeah.
Now, that'd be the way I'd do
it. Yeah.
But, you know,
be very cumbersome on the
ready to...
Well, do they do it on the same day?
No, they don't necessarily do it on the same day.
Okay. No. I don't know how I feel about it. I have to think about that one and see exactly what the proposal is. But it...
Yeah, sure.
So, anyway, that was the Australian Law Reform Commission came out and said that. So, see what happens in that sphere.
Yeah.
The Pope. We can't have an episode of the Iron Fist and the Velvet Glove, Scott, without mentioning the Pope.
Without talking about the Pope, yes.
And I'm now subscribing to Catholic News, which is proving to come up with something every week for me. And golly gosh, the Pope is now going to meet with... Now, previously what's been happening is there's been a Catholic head of state, like a Catholic president or a Catholic prime minister, or heaven forbid, a Catholic dictator, who is divorced and then has remarried without an annulment, and then the head of state and his wife visit the Pope. What's been happening in the past is that the Pope meets with the husband, not necessarily the husband, but with the head of state, and then subsequently meets the spouse in a separate sort of waiting room, ante room, because it wasn't considered proper for this sort of person to meet the Pope with the head of state. And he's such a generous spirit, our Pope now, Scott, that from now on, Catholic heads of state in irregular marital unions will be able to meet the Pope along with their spouse. What a guy. With all of the troubles in the world, he solved one of them. It's a very select group. There's not a lot of them, but they'll be very happy.
Yeah, I mean, there's not a lot of them. You're right. There's not a lot of them, but they will be very happy. And I find it, incredible that he's prepared to... waive the rules on remarriage and that sort of stuff for these important people, but not for everyone else.
Well, I don't know what happens when he meets other people in irregular relationships. So, but heads of state previously, spouse shuffled off to the side and met subsequently, but now they get to meet the Pope at the same time. So, meanwhile, millions of people living in abject poverty, not allowed to contraceptives, blah, blah, blah. Just, that's the Pope getting his priorities in order. Scott, another article, this one from Salon. Four reasons the Christian right's claims of moral superiority are so absurd. So,
yeah.
Longish article, and... the four reasons given, have traditional Christianity's claims of moral superiority always been more conceit, now visible to all, or has something changed? And it's basically reason to believe that Bible-believing Christianity once worked better than it does today, perhaps because the internet makes it harder to live a double life or hide hypocrisies. So, anyway, the four reasons given in this article why the claims for moral superiority are absurd are, well, number one, you've got these archaic sex and gender scripts that drive hypocrisy. So as gender roles and intimate relations become more flexible in modern society, the rigid Iron Age sexed script gets harder and harder for Bible-believing Christians to impose. So they just have a real problem with sex and trying to control people's sex lives and what people should be doing. Yeah. and the hypocrisy where they're found to be not doing the right things themselves just makes the whole moral... It's just an Iron Age morality in relation to sex. Another one is clinging to creationism is just, in this day and age, just unacceptable. People just can't agree to that. We've got this basically a quest for political power has been driving corruption. So we've got this union now of religion and politics, and what's happening is you've got economic libertarians manipulating conservative Christians for political purposes. So in the USA, you've got these characters who are claiming to be religious, but they've got extraordinarily hardline free market capitalist ideas, and they're saying that these are Christian religious ideas, which are sort of, you know, survival of the fittest, don't look after the poor, and that's a that's come about as a function of a quest for political power by religions. So they've got mucked up with that crowd, who are more concerned with the rich getting richer than the helping out the poor. And what's the other one? The tribal, racist, sexist worldview of the Bible appears ever more cruel and morally stunted. So that was the four reasons given as to the morality claims of the Christian right. So there's a link to that. Scott, now we got confused last week. Dear listener, when you were listening to the podcast, we were talking about a situation in Pakistan and a murder of a government official, and I ended up just cutting it out of the podcast because we got mucked up. But we're going to revisit it this week. And so it might have seemed really odd at one stage where we said, you know, I'll never be visiting Pakistan or Saudi Arabia. And that was because I'd edited out a section beforehand where we just sounded like nincompoops. But to make up for that, Pakistan, what an appalling country. So
it's a mess.
It is. Yeah. So what we had was a lady in jail for blasphemy. She was a Christian, and it was sort of a trumped-up blasphemy anyway. And it spent about 5 years. The governor of Punjab, Salman Taseer, so he's the governor, he was criticising the blasphemy laws that were incarcerating this poor woman, and he was denouncing these blasphemy laws. And what happened was that his own bodyguard shot him because of that. Like, didn't like that idea. So the bodyguard is tried and then executed for murder. And the appalling part of all this, dear listener, is that this murderer, at his funeral, tens of thousands of people turned up to support the murderer, basically saying it was a good job killing the governor of Punjab because blasphemy laws need to be protected.
Yeah, it's really, really shows the level of indoctrination that must have been going on in these people's lives, all of their lives, to end up giving them that distorted worldview that, you know, someone deserved to be murdered because of blasphemy laws.
So tens of thousands turn up at this funeral for this murderer as solidarity for him. Terrible. As a statistic, nearly two-thirds of Pakistani Muslims support the death penalty for leaving their faith. Mm. Good Lord, like, oh God, that's a lot of indoctrination to overcome when people come here.
Well, it is. It's a hell of a lot of indoctrination for them to overcome, and it's a wonder that they are that Pakistan's involved in anything internationally. Yes. You know, it's phenomenal that you've got 2/3 of Pakistanis saying that they support the death penalty for leaving the religion, and then you've also got the Pakistani cricket team being able to play anywhere in the world.
Yes.
You know, I find that amazing.
Mm. Like in the days of South Africa and apartheid, like, you know, the world community shunned them for what was going on there.
Mm. Yeah, exactly. Mm.
Well, you know, no amount of outside pressure would change anything in Pakistan anyway, would it? Like, just wouldn't change anything. Did you get to see that... the program I told you about, the Australians fighting in Afghanistan on ABC?
I have started it, yes.
Because
yes.
The final episode was on last night, and anybody out there,
right,
catch up somehow on ABC TV and watch the Australian involvement in Afghanistan, and then tell me that you want boots on the ground in Syria after what... I challenge you, Velvet Glove, next time we speak, when you eventually watch those episodes... Tell me when you've finished watching them, and then we'll have the Syrian discussion again as to whether we should have boots in the ground. That'll be good. So,
all right, I'll give that a go.
Now, Church of Scientology, an article here. In the UK, basically they ran an ad stating that they'd been helping... people,
24 million people
in times of need, in this TV ad, and the UK watchdog said, well, hang on a minute, 24 million, what evidence have you got for that? And Church of Scientology couldn't come up with it.
Yes.
So in the end, the ad was banned in the UK. So fantastic that they've done that. I haven't seen any Church of Scientology ads here in Australia, Scott?
No, neither have I. I mean, it must have been something that they were just running in the UK, because I haven't seen any advertising for them for a long time.
But that was good, 24 million, and it was pulled up and said, well, that can't be right, and turned out to be the case. Now, Scott, how did I come across this one? It's a story about, I think I was looking at celibacy of the Catholic priests in general, and
yes.
Basically, you know, because my view, dear listener, is that, you know, one of the root causes of the problems of child abuse in the Catholic Church is the fact that these priests, you know, they're not allowed to get married. I mean, how sexually frustrated must these guys be? I'm not allowed to get married, not allowed to have sex with anybody. So,
yeah,
like, it's just a recipe for disaster. This article says that priestly celibacy is a law rather than a doctrine. It's still a very ancient one. It's true that the universal requirement of celibacy in its present form dates from the first and second Lateran councils in the 12th century, but its desirability as a requirement for the priesthood is a subject discussed by the early church fathers and was well established by the early 4th century. So, desirable in the 4th century and mandatory in the 12th century. But, Scott, did you know that it is possible to be a married Roman Catholic priest?
Yes, you've got to go via the Anglican road.
Very good, Scott. You're up to speed on that. So, dear listener, I had no idea of this, but when the Church of England was in a bit of upheaval, I think because of...
women being ordained as priests.
Yes. The Roman Catholics thought, well, here's a chance to poach some good players from a neighbouring team. And they said, well, here we are from this article. This is back in 2009. The Roman Catholic Church is to allow married Anglican converts to become priests in a radical concession to tempt them to defect. Married Anglican vicars have been able to convert and join the Roman priesthood since the 1950s, but this is the first time that married non-vicars have been allowed to become priests. Let me get that right in my head. Married Anglican vicars have been able to convert and join since the 15th. Married non-vicars have been allowed. Ah, so if you're a married non-vicar, you can become a priest. So anyway, the short answer is yes. If you're Anglican and married and then convert to Catholicism, then you can. Like, how stupid is that, Scott?
Yeah, it's crazy. Like,
supposedly, you know, a Catholic priest is not allowed to marry because he has to have full attention to devote to Jesus and God and his flock, and couldn't possibly have enough, you know, love left in his body to also, you know, be married. But then they say that some people can, just because it's convenient, if they've been a former Anglican. Like, it's so hypocritical, so nonsensical. It's just classic religious nonsense, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
How it really is.
It's crazy.
How can you maintain that with a straight face?
Well, you can't. You know, that's the whole point about this, is that I remember when they announced this, and it was at the time there were Catholics who were saying this will be the beginning of the end of the priesthood. Yep. Well, it is the beginning of the end of the priesthood. You know, it's going to end up meaning that you're going to have no celibate male priest left.
Well, Scott, if you're a very clever Catholic priest and you're thinking, I'd like to marry this woman in my congregation I've got my eye on, what I should do is leave the Catholic Church, join the Anglicans, marry her, and then come back into the Catholic Church. Does that sound like a plan?
It sounds like a plan.
The problem is, you can't do that. Catholic priests who left their church to marry will not be allowed to return as members of the Anglican convert congregations. So the Catholics are aware of that and said, well, you can't do that. It seemed like a nifty loophole there. But no, you can't do that. Oh, jeez. Just...
It's, yeah. Horrible. It's a hell of a mess. Yeah.
Now, we're going to mix two topics here. The monarchy, the Queen, and God, Scott. But before we do, I heard Peter Fitzsimons talking on Philip Adams' podcast, and he was saying that we've got a prime minister in favour of a republic, we've got an opposition leader in favour of a republic, and every premier of every state is in favour of a republic.
Yes.
Good time to be...
It is a good time to be a Republican, and it is one of those things that really they probably should just push forward with.
I got an awful feeling that Turnbull, though, is going to be a bit like Anastasia Palaszczuk. Like, he's finally got power and he's not willing to do anything with it.
Well, that's certainly a possibility. I mean, like, I know he's been held up by the hard right of the party and that sort of stuff, but... you know, maybe after the election, if he wins the next election, which he probably will, you know, maybe he might feel more comfortable then.
So the Peter Fitzsimons view of the Governor-General situation was, he said, currently the Prime Minister nominates a Governor-General and he asks the Queen for consent. And what he would do is, again, have the Prime Minister nominate a Governor-General and simply put it to the Parliament to consent. And he would still call this person the Governor-General, and everything would be exactly the same, except rather than asking the Queen for consent, you would ask the Parliament for consent. And I think that's pretty compelling argument, I reckon. Was that your view on that? Were you wanting direct representation of the Governor-General / President, or were you happy?
Well, look, I would have preferred a generally elected president. However, I don't think that's going to happen. So, my next best option is probably the minimalist view, where you take the view of the world that you maintain the name, because rather than the name of the country changing to the Federal Republic of Australia, you maintain the name Commonwealth of Australia. You maintain the name Governor General. You do all that sort of stuff.
The only change would be that you seek the consent of the Parliament rather than the Queen. I reckon that is, that is a winner. I think I'm on board with Peter Fitzsimons over that.
Yeah.
Anyway, as part of my subscription to the Bible Society, there is an article about the Queen reflecting on God's faithfulness as the king she serves. In a strong statement of faith to mark her 90th birthday, Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth has said that she is very grateful to the nation for its prayers for her, and that she has felt God's faithfulness during her 64 years on the throne. So there's a book out called The Servant Queen. And the book's co-author, Mark Green, said he was struck by the interest he uncovered in the Queen's personal faith. Blah, blah, blah. Queen's the head of the Church of England, isn't she, Scott?
She is, yes. She's the head of the Church of England, yes.
And, here's a guy who's saying, oh, isn't it interesting that the Queen's actually got faith? That's part of one of the job descriptions.
Would have thought so.
Anyway, I wonder if she felt the God's faithfulness during her annus horribilis year. Don't think she was feeling God's faith that year, Scott.
I wouldn't have thought so, no.
Okay, so there's a book, dear listener, The Servant Queen, if you're interested in the Queen's feelings.
And you can get it for $5.
Is that what it was? I didn't look. I didn't look at the price.
BibleSociety.org.au. Sold for outreach. Yes, at $5 a copy.
Okay. That's that one. ACL. Let me just see. ACL.
Who does the ACL speak for?
You got that one in front of you?
Yes. Who do they speak for? Well, this is an interesting article. It pulls it all apart and goes down to the membership of the ACL. And what it comes up with is that they speak for no one and they speak for every Christian. there are There was a number of faith leaders that were named as being associated with the ACL. And they had, as being head of their congregations and that sort of stuff, and being linked to the ACL, the ACL therefore claims to speak on their behalf. Now, 40 faith leaders have distanced themselves from you last week, challenged Dr. Phelps, referring to an open letter calling on the Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull to abandon plans for the plebiscite. Now, this was that quote there was in relation to the argument between Karen Phelps and Lyle Shelton on Q&A last week or the week before. And it's a very interesting article. But the final line, I think, breaks it down nicely. It said, this means that the ACL can truly say that they represent their views. Church leaders will also speak for themselves, and ACL is careful not to present itself as an official peak council. So that in itself says that the ACL represents everyone and represents no one. So I was no clearer at the end of it all as to who the ACL actually represents.
Yeah. So I've quoted a couple of surveys saying that Christians are against same-sex marriage, therefore, saying the majority of Christians are against same-sex marriage, therefore the ACL speaks for the majority of Christians when it opposes same-sex marriage. But the statistics that they trot out are fairly dubious. So from churchgoers in a five-yearly church census, so anyway, Bible Society basically saying, hands off our Lyle Shelton, he speaks for us and he can continue to do so, is the summary of the Bible Society. What else did I have here? Just a little thing about a Bible masterclass. I can't find it in front of me, but a Bible masterclass being promoted as a day event in Brisbane, and this was sent out, and clergy and school chaplains were encouraged to consider students who should attend and invite them along. And it's just a classic case of you know, chaplains are supposed to not proselytize, yet here was a publication saying that think about which kids you've got who might be suitable for this Bible masterclass and bring them along. It's all free. And so the whole notion of the chaplains being actually, I've got it here. Again, Bible Society and the masterclass. And the Bible Society invites principals, teachers and chaplains to consider which Year 10 and 11 Christian students would benefit from a day of quality input that will invest in their spiritual development and better prepare them to be spiritual leaders of their school and local community. Well, a school chaplain should have nothing to do with considering kids who should go to that event. It's totally against what they should be doing.
Well, that's exactly right. It's crazy that they put them up there and said, well, you know, this is who they should be talking to.
Yep. Yeah. So, Scott, we once again, I think, just about at our sort of regular hour and 10-minute section.
Yeah, we are. And, yeah, that's a pity. We'll hold this. The Moscow nanny who severed the child's head. Well, he said Allah ordered
let's
her.
Let's do that one. So go ahead. Yep.
Yeah, okay.
Yep.
Moscow nanny severed a child's head and then brandished the head around a metro station. She has been arrested and is now being held. Have raised the possibility she might be suffering from mental illness, according to Russian investigators. Well, you know, you'd hope it's mental illness. She killed this toddler, or little baby anyway, and decapitated the child's head and swung the head around outside a metro station in Moscow. It's pretty disgusting what she did.
Look, it just religions have got a lot to answer for, to even put notions in people's heads. I've been reading a book, No Meek Messiah, and in that he details a section of basically killings in America where Christians kill their kids because they think that they've got demons in them, and also kill them by failing to provide medical attention because they figure that that's, you know, not allowed under the Bible. So, classic case of the dangers of faith. I mean, when you tell somebody that you don't have to look at something critically and just have faith in things, then anything's possible. So it's a dangerous notion to play with and bandy around, to say to people, You know, it's this is the thing. Richard Dawkins makes this point, and I think I might play this at the end of our little discussion here, Scott. But he makes the point that that faith is a very dangerous thing. That, you know, if you can, and it's promoted as a virtue, like, you know, if you listen to Lyle Shelton and other people, and they talk about faith, it's said as a good thing, having faith. And faith is just pretending to believe something is true when you know it's not, or you don't know what the truth is. Like, it's just having a faith is nothing virtuous at all, to just believe in something without evidence is...
It's bordering on madness to believe in something without any evidence.
And his argument is that, you know, in this interview, and I definitely will play it now, he's being interviewed with a guy who says, well, you know, what problem do you have if people want to, you know, just conduct their religion in their own private affairs and just why shouldn't they be able to do that? And he said, well, in their own private affairs, they can. And the problem is they're often trying to force themselves on the rest of us. But he did say that even the low-key religious people are performing a disservice for the community in that they are paving the way for the religious extremists by saying that faith is a virtue. So if it's given out across the board that faith is a good thing, then you are just paving the way for the religious extremists to grab susceptible people and use that notion of faith and get them to do the most diabolical things. Because, so dear listener, maybe at the end of the music here, we'll say our goodbyes now, Scott.
Yes, thank you very much, Trevor, for indulging me in that last bit.
And music must be playing in the background now, I think. We'll talk to you all later, and at the end of the music, a little bit from Richard Dawkins. Bye, everyone.
Okay, bye, everyone. Thank you.
How can so many people be wrong?
Well, there was a time when everybody believed that the world was flat. There was a time when everybody believed that the sun whizzed round the earth. People are very, very frequently deluded. And by the way, of course, there was a time when people believed in Zeus and Apollo, and in other parts of the world they believed in Thor and Wotan. People have believed in fairies and leprechauns. Everybody in this room, I would guess, knows what it's like not to believe in the god of some other religion. You know that if you happen to be born in the Middle East, you'd probably be Muslim. And people who are born in the Middle East believe equally fervently in their god. They can't both be right. There are so many different gods that people have believed in throughout history.
So what they people believe is really an accident of geography.
Exactly right, yes.
It would be fair enough if you said, look, this is stuff and nonsense, believe it if you wish, and carry on, you're not doing anyone any harm. But you believe the contrary, that religious is actively harmful.
No, I mean, I do say carry on. I don't say that it's actively harmful in most cases. I think in the great majority of cases it's completely harmless. And one could say the same thing of astrology and belief in telepathy and belief in water divining, all these things for which there's no evidence. There is a minority of people for whom it actually is harmful, the extremists. And a good case can be made that the decent, moderate people, just about everybody in this room, are in a sense paving the way, making the world safe for the extremists. Because decent, moderate, sensible, middle-of-the-road religious people teach children that faith is a virtue. That means believing something without evidence. And there's a minority of people who will take that really, really seriously, and they'll say, my holy book tells me that I've got to go out and kill infidels, kill apostates, that I've got to go and make a suicide bomber of myself, I've got to go and fly planes into skyscrapers in New York. It's only a minority. But if it wasn't for faith being given a free ride, but if it wasn't for faith being touted as a virtue, Just about everybody in our civilization is taught that faith, that means belief without evidence, is a good thing, it's a virtue. Indeed, the less evidence there is, the more virtuous you are in believing it.
Well, dear listener, did you enjoy that episode of the podcast? If you did, I've got a favour to ask. First up, tell some friends. Let them know about the podcast. You'll be discussing something at some time, and you might be repeating something I've said. And when you're talking to your friends, say, hey, I heard this on this podcast, and it's worth listening to. And maybe pick an episode that you think's a good one and direct them to it. Like, grab their phone and go to their podcast app and search for Iron Fist Velvet Glove and subscribe on their behalf on their phone and just put the word out. The other thing is you could become a patron and support the show. So if you go to our website, you'll see a link to Patreon, and there are some different options for subscribing and paying per episode. And really, the amount that you pay depends on what you get from the podcast. So there's different levels ranging from $1.50 Australian to, I think, $10 and various ones in between. It's really, what do you think it's worth? Is it worth a cup of coffee? Is it worth more than that, less than that? Whatever you get out of it, because not everybody gets the same. Maybe you don't listen to the whole thing. Maybe you never talk about it with people. Maybe you really couldn't care less half the time whether the podcast is there. It'll be different for everybody. So if you get a lot out of the podcast, contribute a bit more. If you don't get much, contribute less. But in any event, you can subscribe there. If you don't like the idea of a regular subscription, the website has a link to a PayPal donation. So you could just do a one-off donation every now and again. So there you go. It'd be good to spread the word, get a few more listeners. And that way, look, if we ended up getting more listeners and more money, we could do maybe a second episode or more special episodes, provide some more content. So it's up to you. If you think it's worthwhile, let people know. Thanks.